That's the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with Take Five, the great jazz standard. It's from their 2016 album, Step Forward. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we're talking about something that kind of crept into my consciousness, and that's why it became, to me, a story. I know it's kind of egocentric, isn't it? That because it happened to me, it's therefore a story. Well, before I get to that, though, I just want to say I didn't mean to bring anybody down yesterday. Not that I got word that I did. But, you know, we have to constantly keep tabs on the changing nature of how we feel, where we are at any given moment, especially in this field that we're in and with these precepts that we have, that we hold dear. Sometimes it gets to be a bit much, you know, and you see that people are making such an extraordinary effort to move ahead 2 inches, 3 inches, and there's always something or someone waiting to just bash you down. But anyway, we do have to continue working, and I talked with Elena Herrada and with Abayomi Azikiwe because as Detroiters and in the field for so long, they're just not giving up. So it was good to get a little boost from them yesterday, and also the reminder that, hey, this comes with the turf. It happens. And I've been around long enough to know that. But it just drove me crazy, you know. And it occasionally does. It comes in waves. When you look at where we are as a country, and you say to yourself, there's just no excuse for this. There's no excuse for this primitive way of operating and causing so much suffering among so many people for no reason at all other than, well, I got the power and I could do whatever I want. There's nothing you can do to touch me. And I yearn for the day when we have evidence that, yes, we can do something about it, and you're out of here. Okay, so that's my monologue. But today I want to talk about something because it's related to media, and I've been in this field for a while. And the reason I came to media, newspapers, television, radio, and other things that have become available because of advancements in technology. We do podcasts and all this other kind of stuff. Is the not just the paucity of information relating to distressed communities, and by distressed I mean specifically African-American, Latino communities that used to be called minority communities. There's been an evolution in the nomenclature there. We now call communities of color. But you know what I'm talking about. The relationship between information and ultimately power. And the reverse is true. The lack of information or the lack of solid information, credible information, also links to the exact opposite, the lack of power. But we're seeing an interesting transition. Back in the day, and I'm talking about the 60s, principally, the line of demarcation was very stark. We knew what we should read, where we should go for our information. If you're black, you're reading the Amsterdam News or the City Sun. Okay. If you're Latino, you're reading in New York City, El Diario La Prensa. You may have some information on a community level with the small papers, but they were geographically limited. They were, if you read a paper out in East New York, it dealt with issues of East New York. If you were from an extremely small minority, you will read those papers that cater to that. Incidentally, in New York City, for example, the most literate community, by that I mean the community with the greatest access and interest in reading and learning things, is in Chinatown. Chinatown has more newspapers than any place else. They have more news radio stations that cater to their needs than any place else. And it is natural because it was an ostracized community, just like the Jewish Forward and papers that connect with specific cultural or racial groups by virtue of the fact that they may speak a different language, they have a different culture that they don't want to mesh into the general culture, and they basically see this as a sense of pride that gives them a separation, a special attention that the major media are not interested in giving them. So they provide these things themselves. And this is the evolution of most all media organizations that grow out of particular cultures, communities of interest, etc. In the 1960s, when there was this effort afoot to normalize, if you will, American society, particular attention was paid to media outlets that were so white, not just in the people employed within them, but in the thinking that went into the so-called news that they presented to the general population. And then in that day, we had the giants. There was really no competition against them. So, no matter what culture you come from, you would tend on a daily basis to tune in to television for the news, which was culturally, racially, and in many more ways biased, racist, completely. But they were the arbiters of news, and therefore they were the arbiters of our reality. They presented the information we are supposed to use. We are not to question it because they were the gods of their day. Whatever they said was the gospel truth. And the reputations of major media outlets, the New York Times, CBS Radio, television, news, these were the gods of their time. Whatever they said was true. Although we know, and they couldn't help it in a way, they saw the world through their own eyes. And it was assumed, because this is the essential element of white supremacy, as they see it, so should you and me. On a percentage basis, If you were to analyze the content of news distributed to the general media at that time, you would think there are no black people, there are no Latinos, there are no Asians, because they weren't even within the realm of consciousness as people, let alone as people having specific informational needs, or people occupying a particularly important place in society as a whole. They just were not there. I remember vividly attending a meeting. This was media people. Okay, but it was a small enough meeting that we can sit around a table. I was there sitting around a table. I was invited, I showed up. And do you know, for the entire meeting, I wasn't there. Yes, there was a person sitting in a seat named Eutrice Leed, but I and all that I represented just simply didn't exist in this meeting. These are media people, big time. And when the pressure came, they yielded a little bit and they started putting faces that they could be seen. And in newspapers, they started attending to stories, presenting stories that they think people of color might be interested in. But in any event, they still continued the pattern that the bulk of those stories, even if they were to cover communities of color or topics of interest to communities of color, it overwhelmingly endorses the negative. It overwhelmingly speaks to the breakdowns of the family, poverty, crime, that kind of thing. Who killed who? Who jumped off a building? These would be the kinds of stories that you would hear about and see as news, which in turn shapes your opinion, including the opinions and attitudes of the people from these communities that they, quote, covered, unquote. So you would not see a story that, not that this is what they have to do, but if by any definition this is called a personal interest story, let's say a little old lady comes to the attention of a community because she plants flowers all throughout the community. And that's a great story, no matter who it is or no matter where it is. But you wouldn't find those kinds of stories at that time that in any way suggested that Black and Latino communities in particular had a human side to them. It was always about murder, drug addiction, who got caught in a serious crime and put in jail and that kind of thing. So the black press, and we will hear more about this from Gerald Horn. He just published a book on the black press, so he will be with us soon. They served a very important need, but they also, and we should look at it that way, the flip side of the coin is that they allowed white media to take, you know, to take off from what I would discuss as their journalistic duties. Their duty is to cover the community, the whole community. But they never did that. So, and yet, this is this was the bastion of liberalism, because the people who worked in the media were supposed to be people, or they tended to be people who positioned themselves as enlightened people, educated people, people interested in moving or helping to move society as a whole forward. And the way the media is supposed to do that is to present fair and balanced reporting. They didn't do that. So we had apartheid, full-scale apartheid in the media. And the 60s helped to dull the edge a bit. And they began to see that there was a black community there, and there was a Latino community there, and there was an Asian community there. And yet the coverage corresponded with their respective racist views of these communities. So they presented the stories that were racist and stereotypical, like a Chinese kid who is a master of the violin, okay, or who is a wizard math, or a black man struggling to make ends meet with three jobs, you know, very noble and everything, but still reinforcing the idea that he is normal because he's unemployed or underemployed. And the storyline essentially is one that we are supposed to be comfortable with, which is that the newspaper is paying attention to a socioeconomic problem, when in fact it is also reinforcing racist attitudes in an effort to be seen as an enlightened entity. You know, so we got a lot of that. And here we are today, in which the media, I think, is in reversion. It's stepping back into the dark ages. And we're seeing in all forms of media a kind of brazenness, a kind of boldness, masquerading or attempting to masquerade as media. You know, you shouldn't be too suspicious of it, because the right people are in the right jobs and they're doing their jobs well, of fairly covering issues and communities. That's not what is happening. What is happening, I think, I could be wrong, you'll tell me. I see the media stepping way back from a sense of mission, and instead arrogating to itself this notion of stardom. And they are doing stories that primarily appeal to advertiser interest, political compromises they're willing to make, so that you know the New York Post is this kind of publication, and you know that the New York Times is that kind of publication appealing to people of a particular political bent. And then you have the outrageous publications that are off the chart, because they go all the way left, and others that are going all the way right. What has been lost, of course, is a sense of mission. They are interested, actually, in taking on stories that they start feeling around early for. Would an advertiser be interested in a special on this? Or on another level, they take on stories that will propel the writer or the presenter, in the case of television, with a high profile, which in turn translates into money, advertising coming in. Now, I can't say that this is not a consideration across the board. Nor can I say it is a consideration across the board. But I can say that more often than not, it is a consideration. So that the motive, from the very motive to the finished product, you have something tainting the process. Fame and notoriety for the person writing the information or somehow filming it or documenting it. And then the industry itself has prizes, which are another incentive to ignore the sense of mission and instead obey the requirements for rewards and recognition and money. That's where we are. That's where the media, the industry is. Now, this came to light. I'll give you an example of the current obsession about the Hollywood sex scandal involving Harvey Weinstein and his alleged and prolific sexual attacks on women in particular. He headed up a company that produced many box office winners and so became quite an influential figure in the movie business, in the industry. And that gave him permission, he thought, and it turned out to be not a bad thought because it proved him right. With power, you can do a lot of things that you normally couldn't do, good and bad. He chose in many cases, and they're still coming in, we're still hearing about it. But what I want to point to is how our attitudes are shaped by media organizations that decide this is what you need to know right now. And for as long as they decide, you need to know it. I know the thinking is number one, sex is a big seller. A sex scandal, even bigger. There is a trait, especially in the white media, that if they're in a position to bring you down or push you up, one way or the other, they're responsible for a major event in your life, and they could make it happen. They'll do it. So we have been treated for the past, what, 3 weeks or so, actually a month or so. And if one wants to count very closely, you could even say this has been a story that has been circulating in the media world for years, a couple of years now. But what do you see? Why is this a major story? Why is it something that should affect our daily lives? And I'll tell you, the determination is very clear. It's a story involving whites, for the most part. This is a white story. And the whites who are involved have very large profiles in the business. And they're coming forward and they're telling these ugly tales. But essentially, it is notables behaving very nastily, covering things up, not talking about it because of the money factor. And here is an opportunity to bask in the glory of opening the window a little bit, cracking it open, but mostly in order to take somebody down. And the stories are not pretty at all, and I'm sure the vast majority of them are real. But somebody decided, I need to make this the center of my daily life. Their troubles, their experiences, their salacious situations, wherever they fall on the line, must be important to me in my daily life. I don't have any of this happening in my daily life, but they will compel me to adopt this as a point of interest in my daily life. It makes money for them because now I'm supposed to descend into their level of operating to find out who was involved, who did what to whom, for how long. And now there is a movement built around this. Many of the female stars, and not just them, because we've had some men come forward and say they were sexually abused as well. Okay, on one level, I could appreciate that this is a story, you know, it's being exposed, and it's got all the tra-la-la that makes a story profitable to cover. High-profile people operating at the highest levels of the industry involved allegedly in some unbelievably disgusting behavior, and basically using that power to subjugate people who just wanted to make a living and force them into these compromising arrangements. And at this time, the principal actor, Weinstein, has been kicked out of his own company. His brother is against him, who was also in the company. And it is looking like it's leading toward the investigation that should have happened a long time ago. But we're not hearing that side of the story too much. How could a situation like this progress to this point? Who failed? Why? Where was the cover-up? Instead, we have a litany of people who said, yes, I was sexually abused, or I was raped, or I was assaulted one way or the other, and that's where the story stays, without us having any understanding of how an entire industry behaved itself. More to the point, misbehaved itself. You see, now that's where the story is. It's not so much, I mean, people know what rape is. People know what power and sex is all about. But we don't get any enthusiastic analysis of how an industry, an entire industry, could misbehave this badly, causing so much injury, and still get along with it, and still survive. It's the same thing with the Clintons. Hillary Clinton remains and is covered as a de facto president, even though she didn't win the election. Every day, somebody decided, because money has been exchanged here, more than likely, somebody has decided it is necessary that you and I and everybody else, we all need to know what Hillary is thinking on a daily basis. I don't want to know. I don't care what Hillary Clinton is thinking. By the way, starting tomorrow, there'll be a very special program. It is going to be groundbreaking about the Clintons. So you want to tune in for that. But I'm saying the role of the media, by acting this way, insists on continuing something from the past that should have gotten over by now. It should understand that it is allegedly committed to the advancement of society. And you have to be very careful these days about the way you cover things. But we are in a white world. On any given day, I can get nothing from mainstream media or close to nothing on mainstream media that speaks to my interest, that speaks to my informational needs, that plugs me into my culture. Nothing. Because somebody decided I don't exist. People like me don't exist. So I'm making the case that this notion of liberalism in the media is a farce. The media organizations have proven that they are viable for the right price. They can persuade the basic mainstream media outlets to look the other way or not even look at all, to write a story. Even in this situation with the sex scandal, the Hollywood sex scandal, part of the story is at a time when the story was to break, actors, high-profile actors, interceded and persuaded the media organization to just junk the story, which it did. And these people today present themselves as they're very progressive people. So we have to remember that all news is not news. And there is still this duality that exists, even in progressive media. They're not even trying, in some cases, to deal with the totality of the impact that their work is having, because they no longer intend for their work to be appreciated except by the special interests that they're serving within the networks, within the non-mainstream community. They're interested in prizes. They're interested in fame. They're interested in making a name for themselves. They no longer, if they ever were, they no longer are committed to contributing to the one thing that, above everything else, could be most effective in bringing a society together. That is, by providing information that allows people to cross over these historic hurdles. They're not interested in that kind of work. So I say this to bring to your attention the fact that there are so many examples that I see every single day of media organizations completely flouting their mission because they now have other considerations. They have a new audience. What does that mean? They want an audience with an average annual income of X. So they'll write for and produce materials for a community that fits that profile. The rest of you could go to hell. They want to be in the group of winners when awards are given out, which means if it is important to write a story contradicting the status quo within the industry, it means that more than likely they will not get an award. So they'll write a story that is worthy of consideration, even if it is crap, in terms of its ability to help this movement forward. The Kerner Commission, back in 1965, this was a commission formed by Lyndon B. Johnson, and it was supposed to pay specific attention to the functioning of media and how media literally played a role in creating, bifurcating our society by being a white supremacist institution. It was recommended, there was a big report called the Kerner Commission Report that talked about the role of media as being so vital in this regard. And it helped, in fact, to spark ownership within non-mainstream communities of media outlets, radio, small television stations, and so forth. And it also encouraged the mainstream press to do its job, to hire more people in its editorial ranks, especially in those who are the gatekeepers in the media world, the people who decide what is information and whether you should have it. And it encouraged a great deal of enthusiasm in non-mainstream communities who were the victims of this in two ways. They're not being covered, the issues are not being covered, and deliberately being shut out of society because of lack of coverage. It helped to energize antisocial forces in our nation. Do you know there was a, well, we don't know because I haven't shared it with you. There was a writer at the New York Times who was hired during this period when the newspapers, radio stations, media people in general were looking to integrate the newsrooms. So she was hired. And the minute she was hired, she was more in love with the idea that her name was associated with the New York Times than with the idea that being associated with the New York Times, she could really stretch out and have some very, very powerful influence writing stories that never would have made it into the paper, and herself being in a newsroom, which was a break with tradition for the New York Times. In fact, it came at the expense of smaller newspapers and other media outfits because they raided the newsrooms of the black press. They raided them. It almost caused the complete collapse of the black press when the major media outlets that did not hire black people suddenly started to be aware that they can't afford to look this bad. So they hired her. And her principal purpose with the New York Times was to legitimize the racist thinking out there about her own community. The stories were always about turmoil in the community, killings. The stories always seemed somehow to suggest that black people cannot be trusted with self-rule. They don't have the capacity to live along with others in a very human way. Almost all of her stories were like that. I confronted her about it one day. I'm not going to call her name, but she ended up being a big deal. A big deal, because now that her work was regularly featured in the New York Times, and these were negative stories, and she served the convenience of being a black person writing this way about black people, then came the television interviews, and she would be on television programs and so forth as the expert on black people. And she continued, she was saying the same thing that the white racists were saying. But in so doing, advanced her career as she saw it, but also legitimized the illegitimate thinking out there. You see this a lot. We were hoping that in that period, that there would be enough of a crossover. At least. I was not interested in a crossover. I loved being and writing for and actually launching black publications dealing with the Pan-African view, a wide view. That was, to me, the best thing ever. Still is. So I make no apologies for that. But I'm saying that we have the going trait, even in the black press, to write nonsense stories, to concentrate on stories that, you know, who is going with whom, who's divorcing whom, as if these things matter. There's no substance to the reporting. It's by design. To throw us all off. When I headed this black newspaper, the City Sun, which I put together and launched, do you know what was a great mark of progress to me was that we had a substantial readership of whites. In fact, our very first subscribers were Pete Seeger and Toshi Seeger. Very first subscribers. And wherever they traveled, they made sure that we had the correct mailing address. And we were read by the most conservative elements in our society, including the governor, Cuomo, governmental agencies, We used to break stories like crazy that they never could get close to, the other papers and news outlets. And that is because we had a mission. Our motto was speaking truth to power. That's what we did. No apologies. We weren't reckless. We were very responsible and operated at the highest standards of journalism. So it is not that it can't be done. It is about whether the organization and news outlet, the media outlet, considers it important enough to be a mission. But when you have stories about, you're having stories, you consider as a story, somebody's breakup. You're reverting. There isn't, except I would say for the Nation of Islam and its publication, the Chicago Defender, and perhaps one or two others, that's it for responsible reporting in the black community so far. Same thing has happened to the Latino community. Because now the people in power are choking the media outlets that could do the greatest work, choking them by denying them advertising or by holding it over their head as a bartering chip. We want you to write about this. They have nothing else to, no other revenue coming in as much as movies and so forth. So they comply, they capitulate. The moment a news organization catches wind of a writer's byline, they keep tabs, and at the right time they reach out and snatch him or her right out of the publication that invested in their skills, gave them an opportunity to grow and to learn the business. All right, I've gone kind of wide here. I understand that. I'm recognizing it. But what I want to come back to is the role of media in shaping public opinion. And right now, everybody has to be very careful about what is being disseminated. I raised the question of Hillary Clinton as the de facto kind of president. She has no reason to be involved, at least at this level. Every day there's a Clinton story. What does that mean? It means that she's in big trouble and can reasonably rely on constant coverage because there's money exchanging hands here to keep her public so that whenever whatever falls, she has some kind of cushioning, some sector of the community that will be sympathetic to her and supportive of her. That's what this is shaping this whole thing up to be. It's not about what she thinks. It is in exchange for access, in exchange for some kind of money. It would be disguised as advertising. What she is buying is a cushion. And then news outlets that have no sense of mission anymore. They have no sense of dignity anymore. It's money, as long as it doesn't stink, as long as we could make it look to be something else, you know, here, buy my book, a big nice ad, and you'd pay a lot of money for a long run. But that's how the media are functioning today. There's nothing that is absolute. They're not following any rules about, you know, what is the standard that you're maintaining here? What are you telling white people about black people and Latinos and Asians? What are you telling these groups about white people? Nothing. Except that they are in charge. We are back firmly in the white supremacist phase historically. These are the people who matter. Their opinions matter. Their concerns matter. And therefore, nothing else matters. And if it does matter, it's way down the line, way down on the bottom rung of the ladder. And we look at this intentional departure from mission in service of these kinds of people. You can see directly this is an absolute correct explanation of why we have Donald Trump, of why our system is so messed up. Because they're not doing the work. They're supposed to be the sentries at the post. They're supposed to be the people keeping everybody and everything running smoothly because they are maintaining surveillance. They're keeping things honest. Instead, they are part of the problem. And we should always be aware of it, even in progressive media. Here at PRN, the effort clearly is being made that people present honest work, free from taint, free from influence, free from the owners of information out there, the corporations who want positive spin, the institutions who want cover-ups. But even so, you got to watch everybody and question. Make use of the information, but also leave a lot of room for further investigation and assessment by you before you take it in. Ask the logical questions and be careful that you have no limits at all. Everything that comes out of a publication or a radio station or some other thing that you like is only going to tell you the absolute truth. They can make mistakes. Some of them may be compromised. You never know. But you have to be conscious of what you're taking in and not assume that, well, they said it, therefore it's right. No, no. You do further reading. You can give some media outlets that kind of trust if over a length of a very long period of time they have proven to be ethical and accurate. But trust none of these media organizations today, with everything, you know, within you, because it's been said. You have to remember their motives that we don't know or we haven't seen. Their relationships that they may be fulfilling particular relationships because of money or influence or whatever it is. But in any event, they may be compromised. And in any event, the whole role of media, and we have to ascribe this to that section of the industry, the whole role of media is to have influence over our thinking. Because when you influence people's thinking, you influence their actions. You influence what they do. And that's the name of the game in the United States. That's why it is a propagandistic industry. Somebody pays to get a hold of our minds. I'm saying to you today, don't let them, don't do it, and inspect everything you consume in the way of information, especially the important things. But always keep in the back of your mind that there are so many things out here masquerading as true and desirable as right that really are throwbacks to the good old days of white media. And I say that in the political sense. We got to get over that. So thank you so much for listening today. Again, I urge you and others through you to tune in tomorrow. We'll be doing 2 days. It's a very huge story, and it is breaking exclusively here on my program for the first time anywhere in the world. I encourage you to listen. Bye-bye.